This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Two quick comments on what we heard this morning. One of them is on origins. Of course, there's a very nice doctor who lives in Balmain, Louisa Road actually, called Dr. John Colley, who's a friend of mine, who once wrote a movie for Peter Weir called Master and Commander, starring some Russell chap. Well, he's now written a book called Origin, with Paul Bettany playing Darwin and Elizabeth Connolly playing Emma. And the shooting finished at the end of 2008, and they're into post-production, and with any luck, it'll be out not far too distant future. And John Colley does a wonderful script, and he understands the science. And the book, of course, is based on Annie's Box by Randall Keynes. I had another person to do with the movies on February the 14th. A fellow called Matthew Chapman, who's a great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin, who writes movies for Bruce Willis and Dustin Hoffman and Victoria Tennant. In fact, he used to be married to Victoria Tennant. And he grew up in Cambridge, but then saw the light and became a rather productive writer of feature films. So the movies are progressing. Another one is supposed to be done by Fred Skepsey, produced by Penny Chapman, whose two biographies of Darwin you may have seen on SBS 2 weeks ago. So much for the background in the movies in Hollywood. This afternoon, in the final sprint towards 3 o'clock, when we'll have some Q&A, is presented by Bernadette Hintz, who's a dear friend of mine. She's a historian and lexicographer. She is a visiting fellow at the ANU's Dictionary Centre. Her main research interests are in the history of words in the polar regions, and she's written the Antarctic Dictionary, A Complete Guide to Antarctic English, something every household needs. Because you can look up the word snotsicle. You probably don't need to. Only in Antarctica could that happen to be a compelling word. The other thing you need to know about Bernie is she's a fabulous cook, and as far as I know, is the world expert on Emma's own cooking style. So you can ask her questions about that. Bernie, would you please chair the afternoon?
Thank you very much, Robin. Welcome to the afternoon session. We have three very different speakers from diverse backgrounds to talk about the legacy, Darwin's legacy. You've been a wonderfully quiet audience, and I'd just like to remind you to check that any mobile phones or squeaky devices are turned off. So, first of all, we start with Colin Groves, Professor of Biological Anthropology here at the Australian National University. And Colin is going to talk to us on human evolution, fossils surprising, fossils predicted. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you. Darwin, of course, had this one enigmatic sentence in The Origin of Species about human evolution, the possibility of human evolution, but the man who put it centre stage was this, Thomas Huxley. And in 1863, he wrote a paper, which in fact was based on a lecture which he'd given, called Man's Place in Nature. And he compared human and ape skeletons with a sort of vaguely evolutionary slant on it, and he introduced a very important idea in it, the missing link. He said, remember, if you will, that there is no existing link between man and the gorilla, but do not forget that there is a no less sharp line of demarcation, a no less complete absence of any transitional form between the gorilla and the orang, or the orang and the gibbon. And 1863, the first really outing of human evolution after Darwin. Link. Existing link. The person who actually put the two words together, missing and link, was Hugh Falconer. Falconer had discovered an unusual human skull in Gibraltar in 1848. There it is, bottom right. He was a friend of Darwin. He was impressed. I don't know whether he actually accepted Darwinian evolution, but certainly he was well disposed towards it. And he compared the Gibraltar skull to a similar skull discovered in Germany in 1856 from the famous Neanderthal, the valley of the hymn writer Neander. And he wrote to a relative, and this was published posthumously after his death in 1868, "If you hear any remarks made, you may say from me that I do not regard this Priscan Pithecoid man as the missing link, so to speak," the first mention of this phrase in print. "It is a case of a very low type of humanity, very low and savage and of extreme antiquity, but still man, another halfway step between man and monkey." So at once he is introducing what's now a sort of much misused catchphrase. He's bringing for the first time fossils into the story of Darwinism, and he is also beginning to treat fossils quite seriously as possible elements in the Darwinian story. So now let's go forward one century. What's been happening in discoveries of fossils in the human lineage since then? Well, we have Australopithecus africanus. This we now know, but was not known at the time of its discovery, is 2+ million years old. It's got an endocranial volume, that means volume inside the brain case, 440 cc's, which is about a third of the average of ourselves. It's got small canine teeth, not large ones like an ape. It's got the pelvis of a biped, but it's still not completely modern. There's details in which it's not completely modern in its bipedal form. There's a skull of it. There's a innominate bone, half a pelvis. Then we knew of Australopithecus or Paranthropus. Most people now refer it to a different genus, Paranthropus, Robustus and Boisei, sometimes called robust Australopithecines. These are 1 to 2 million years old. They're definitely a sideline. Everybody, with a couple of exceptions, admits now that that is the case, that we do have at least this one sideline in human evolution, skulls of them. Big, robust things with crests on their heads and huge, huge jaws but flat faces. Then we knew of Homo erectus, which was discovered in Java in 1891, and other specimens had been discovered since then. And this we now know ranges in age from about 500,000 to over 1 million, but the exact dates at either end are still under discussion. The cranial capacity, endocranial volume of this is 1,000 cc, so it's getting up well up towards the modern human range, and unexpectedly large brow ridges. There's a brow ridge for you. And then, of course, Homo sapiens, average cranial capacity about 1,300 cc, but extremely variable, of course. And how human evolution looked about, say, 1960 was like this. You see, there's a stem, AA, is Australopithecus africanus. There's a single branch, Australopithecus robustus, Boisei being related. And then the stem goes on up to HE, Homo erectus, and HS, Homo sapiens. So that's how it looked then. And then, well, we expect, you see, to find, obviously, an intermediate between Australopithecus africanus, the supposed ancestor, and the next stage up, supposedly Homo erectus. So it was expected to find this intermediate, and it was found in 1964, and it was described as a new species, Homo habilis, and for the first time, radiometric dating was applied to the site where it was found, Olduvai Gorge, and it was found that the specimens referred to Homo habilis were between 1.6 and 1.8 million years old. And the cranial capacity, the endocranial volume, 650 to 680 cc's, nicely intermediate, you see, between Australopithecus africanus and Homo erectus. And the foot, to quote Day and Napier, indicates that bipedal walking had achieved an almost modern degree of advancement. You see, a nice foot skeleton was found along with all these jaws and skull fragments. In fact, it was so intermediate between Australopithecus africanus and Homo erectus that many commentators, you see, there's always people who are trying to put their own oar in and trying to sort of, if you like, put their own spin on what's been discovered. So many people didn't accept Homo habilis. Why not? The expected intermediate species? Well, the answer is that, you see, it was considered by some that some of the specimens referred to it should actually have been classified as Australopithecus africanus, but advanced Australopithecus africanus, and the others as early Homo erectus. So these people were, if you like, having a bob each way. You know, they're intermediate, but not a new species. And how human evolution now looked was like this. There's the new species, HH, bottom right, you see, intermediate between Australopithecus africanus and Homo erectus. Still a nice, steady evolution, onward and upward, branching off at one point, but essentially going from then to now in one single branch. Then came some surprising fossils. Australopithecus afarensis. Everybody had been very happy with Australopithecus africanus until this was discovered, and it's early. 3.0 to 3.7 million from a site in Ethiopia, Hadar, and a site in Tanzania, Laetoli. And the cranial capacity was slightly less on average than Australopithecus africanus, and it included some very well-preserved fossils indeed. The famous fossil Lucy, there's a skeleton on the far right, was discovered at Hadar, and a series of fossils all found together, thought at the time to have been part of a single social group and known as the first family. And there were abundant other, more fragmentary remains from Hadar. Laetoli had only some rather fragmentary remains, jaws and a fragmentary skeleton, but did show footprints embedded in volcanic ash. And there's one illustrated there. Why was this surprising? Well, it was surprising for a number of reasons. First of all, as I said, everybody had been satisfied with Australopithecus africanus, but this put a new light on it. And first, I must mention the long time span. People thought, you know, evolution was steady and gradual. Darwin had almost said as much. In fact, Huxley had twitted him on, I think you are unwise to have rejected the idea that nature makes no leaps. And of course, if nature makes leaps, then there must, before and after the leap, be stasis, be a period of relative calm when there is little or no change. And indeed, Australopithecus afarensis had a very long time span when very little did appear to happen within it, a period of stasis. The species was very widely distributed. Ethiopia and Tanzania are something like 2,000 kilometres apart. It had great sexual dimorphism. Nobody had expected that, one of our perhaps ancestors had huge males and tiny females. And some of the facial features resembled Homo, suggesting that Australopithecus africanus was actually too specialised to be ancestral to Homo. Surprising, but adding a cog to the story of human evolution. So here's how human evolution now looked. Now, you see, Australopithecus africanus has been pushed off onto a side branch. But, of course, we must have, many people were saying, relatively few branches. Because, after all, humans are special. They must have evolved in a special way. So it was still essentially onward and upward, but still the one side branch. But now Australopithecus africanus has joined the robust ones on the side branch. There's Australopithecus afarensis, you see, on a now rather lengthened stem. still leading up to the split, and on the right-hand side of the split, we still have Homo habilis, Homo erectus, Homo sapiens, 1, 2, 3. Fossil expected. Well, of course, we've got this these robust Australopithecines, Paranthropus, but they need an ancestor too. Australopithecus africanus, maybe, but quite suddenly we have something different. Remember that Paranthropus is 1 to 2 million years old. It, as I pointed out, had these huge jaws and teeth, massive cheekbones, sagittal crest, very flat, foreshortened face, very, very odd-looking creatures indeed. They need an ancestor. What would you predict from this ancestor? Well, perhaps something with more jutting jaws, like the Australopithecus africanus and afarensis. And one turned up. And it's of the right age. It's 2.5 million to be an ancestor of Paranthropus. It's exactly like later Paranthropus, well, almost exactly, but with a protruding snout. So we've given them an ancestor. Entirely predictable. A great fuss was made when this black skull was discovered. I'm not sure why, because I think it was entirely to have been predicted. More fossils expected. We can now go back in time. Australopithecus afarensis had now liberated us from the idea that we must have as short an evolutionary span as possible. We can now look backward, and what comes before that? Well, Australopithecus anamensis, then a genus called Ardipithecus, and then finally one called Aurorin. And these go back to almost 6 million years of age, and we're getting to be, admittedly, these three are all still rather fragmentary in the fossils that we know about them, but we are beginning to get back towards the split with our nearest ape relative, the chimpanzee. And you can see in the middle with the Ardipithecus, you can see already relatively longer canines than we've seen in humans and Australopithecines, not as long as in apes, but certainly getting back towards intermediate stages with apes, especially with chimpanzees. The fossils that one had expected and now predicted, there they turned up. And more that were expected going forwards. Well, we have Homo ergaster found in Kenya between 1.8 and 1.5 million. Again, a bit of stasis. When we compared it with Homo erectus, one of its successors, we saw smaller brows, less flattened brain case. There's a beautiful, nearly complete skeleton of an adolescent on the right, the so-called Turkana boy. And what this did, but people, you see, were prepared for it now. Australopithecus africanus had been pushed off the main line. Maybe Homo erectus. It was surprising to a lot of people that it had these huge brow ridges, very thickened, flattened skull, and Homo ergaster wasn't quite like that. And it did show that Homo erectus is more specialized and is unlikely, therefore, to be the human ancestor, as we had more or less deduced already. So it wasn't too surprising by now, given the previous context. And also, more that were expected, Homo heidelbergensis. Actually, a lot of fossils had been being discovered in the meantime, but mostly fragmentary fossils in both Europe and in Africa between about 1 million and about 300,000 years ago. And better specimens now began to turn up, and we began to see that these were all very much of a muchness. Maybe here, instead of having a lot of fossils preserved at one site, which one could be fairly certain were all of the one species, perhaps we have a lot of fossils widespread over, in this case, Europe and Africa, but all rather looking alike. And the favourite hypothesis at the moment is that these are all one species, which we name after the very first of them to be discovered, the Heidelberg mandible, which is illustrated there. Next to the bottom right. That was discovered in 1908, and it's now proved to have been the first specimen of this later species. So the story is gradually going on and on. But, okay, everybody was very happy. We now know what happened in human evolution. Nothing will surprise us anymore. Is that so? Homo georgicus. What? A jaw was discovered in 1993, and then a series of skulls and one skeleton from 2000 until the present day. And these were intermediate between Homo habilis and Homo ergaster. Wonderful, we'd expected to find an intermediate. That was expected. But the surprise was where they were found. Okay, human evolution took place in Africa, didn't it, until finally there was the great leaving of Africa. There were at least two great leavings of Africa, but, you know, that's the locus of human evolution. Not somewhere in Africa, but in a cold climate, in the Republic of Georgia, at the foot of the Caucasus, at the gates of Europe, as somebody put it. What were our ancestors doing there? Out of Africa, Homo habilis out of Africa to become Homo georgicus, back into Africa to become Homo ergaster. It's all very strange, but here's the specimens. You see, they're wonderful specimens. And one of them was even, when it was discovered, the film of its discovery was actually put immediately on the web, so you could watch them scooping it out and uncovering it and pulling out the new skull and then pouring champagne. So around the year 2000, this is how human evolution was looking. It's not onward and upward anymore. We don't have some just-not-ape scanning and looking at the distant horizon and thinking, I'm going to get there, I'm going to invent television sets. Instead, we have lots of branchings, side branchings, things becoming extinct, things surviving, things telling me that I have only 1 minute left. The human evolutionary tree actually looks much more like other well-known African animals, of which we have a good fossil record. And the two ancestors of the 1960 tree are both sidelines. There we are. There they are in red. They've just appeared in red. They're both sidelines. So that's a bit surprising. In 2000, more surprising fossils were discovered. And look at this magnificent skull, Sahelanthropus chadensis, in Chad, West Africa. What is it? How could anybody possibly still be debating what this skull is, this wonderful specimen? Well, it's according to faunal comparisons with dated sites in East Africa, you can't date a stable site, or not yet, like Coro Toro. You have to have volcanic site like the East African sites. But by comparison with fauna at dated East African sites, it's 6 to 7 million years old, which is about the age, according to the molecular clock, when we split from chimpanzees. So what is it? But it's distorted, you see. And there's a mandibular fragment, a few isolated teeth, that's it. It's got a very small cranial capacity, huge brow ridges, huge sagittal crest, this straight, not protruding face. And the point of balance seems fairly far forward, but it's distorted, so I'm not convinced of that myself. Short canines, apparently. But what sex is it? Females have smaller canines than males anyway. So what are its affinities? It could be at the base of the human stem, the base of the chimpanzee stem, even perhaps the base of the gorilla stem, or perhaps part of the common ancestral stock. I don't know yet. And it's a completely open question. And finally, fossils surprising, absolutely astonishing, so astonishing that people have gone right back to the beginnings. Homo floresiensis, found in Flores, eastern Indonesia. It looks, you know, like a little Australopithecine, doesn't it? But the remains, they're scattered throughout Liang Bua sequence. They're from 75,000 to 12,000 years old. Where's all these millions of years? what's an Australopithecine doing so recently? And there's a fairly complete skeleton called LB1. There's a second jaw, LB6, with some associated postcranial parts, isolated bones and teeth. It was 1 meter high, tiny little thing. It's low cranial capacity in Australopithecine range. It's got brow ridges, protruding jaws, no chin. It's not just no chin. A lot of people probably even here have no chin. It's internally buttressed, like an ape or like an Australopithecine, and that's different. It's not just a matter of being chinless. The shoulder joint has now been analysed. It lacks the rotatory ability of Homo sapiens. The wrist bones lack the full degree of expansion and contraction, specialisation of Homo sapiens. Short legs, long feet, very controversial. And here's a couple of hypotheses about it. The lower one is the one which I'm definitely inclined to support. You want it, you want to look. It's a long, isolated, direct descendant of something like Homo habilis. So there was an earlier dispersal from Africa which reached Indonesia and somehow got across to Flores, which is in east of the so-called Wallace Line. Whether that existed then, I'm not absolutely sure. That is what it seems most likely to me. And the search must now be on, obviously, for what its ancestors were, where it came from. Every one of the really surprising fossils has been vigorously denied. When the Neanderthal skull was first announced and brought in, brought into the scheme of human evolution by Huxley and Falconer, you can read perhaps I'm not allowed the time to read them, are they? No. Okay, they said it was a poor idiot. They said it was due to horse riding that it had these curved thigh bones. And Rudolf Virchow, who actually he was no slouch. He was the founder of the field of paleopathology. But he sort of invented a life history for this poor skull. When Pithecanthropus, which we now know as Homo erectus, was discovered, then this too was thought to be, anything but something intermediate between human and ape. And one guy, Daniel Cunningham, a noted medic of the time, said it's unquestionably human, whereas Virchow, who was still alive at that time, said, no, it's a giant gibbon. And when one says it's human, the other says it's a gibbon, something suggests to me it might be ever so slightly intermediate. And then Australopithecus africanus was disputed as well by the contemporaries when that too was discovered. So why not, in the grand old tradition of denying a surprising fossil, look what they've said about Homo floresiensis. Jacob et al. Said it's drawn from an early pygmy Homo sapiens population, but individually shows signs of a developmental abnormality, including microcephaly. That's a condition where people are born or develop with abnormally small brains, though 400 cc would be extremely, extremely small, though not absolutely unknown. Microcephaly, says Bob Martin. Laron syndrome, a general growth hormone defect, says Gary Richards. Laron syndrome, says Hershkovitz et al. A cretin. Cretins are people with iodine deficiency who develop with small size and usually fairly small brains, but not like this, says Peter Obendorf et al. So what will next week's pathology be, I wonder? They keep coming up and coming up with these things, everything except what's at least staring them in the face. Or as T.H. Huxley put it in 1890 when he commented on the denialists' reaction to the Neanderthal discovery, it could be and was suggested that the Neanderthal skeleton was that of a strayed idiot, that the characters of the skull were in a result of early synostosis or of late gout, and in fact any stick was good enough to beat the dog withal. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.